Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
A friend once said to me, you don't drive a Ferrari in a mucky field, and Keane McPhillips would certainly not be running the National Cross. He is a Ferrari.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
You are welcome back. So we are turning our attention to what I think is one of the most underappreciated sporting teams in the history of this country. So between 1957 and 1966, Dublin won 10 senior camogie titles in a row. In fact, if you go between the years of 1948 and 1966, the Dubs won 18 out of a possible 19 titles. So that's basically 20 years losing one championship match. It's fair to say this is the most dominant run we've seen of any county in any Gaelic game sport at senior level. And I'm delighted to say that Kay Ryder, who has 10 All-Ireland medals from that era, is with us in studio. Kay, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we also have Patricia Woodsney-Timmins, who has 5 All-Ireland medals and a National League title as well. Patricia, thanks a million for joining us as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
So we've been wanting to do this piece for a while, and it kind of feels like the end of September is a great time to do it. This is the time when you were in your pomp. I think, what are we talking now? 60 years since the 1965 title case, and when you were captain that year in 65, I believe you've been honoured in Croke Park for the last number of years in terms of recognising those achievements.
Yes, I have. I'm delighted over it. And I'd forgotten all about those years, I think, at that stage, at this stage in my life, you know. So it was great to see that Dublin were being honoured. They make a big fuss of the team in all the other counties, but they don't get as much fuss made of them in Dublin here.
Yeah.
We're all around the country to get welcome home and a big meeting, and they all meet there, you know. So, Dublin falls short of that. They get no welcome or no congratulations from the Dubliners themselves.
Right. Why is that?
I don't know. It's maybe because the Dublin team is made up of the girls from all parts of Dublin, and Dublin is so big that you couldn't have it in any one area.
Yeah.
And again, Dubliners, they're in Dublin, and but it's the welcome home the others get when they go back. And they get kind of, the train stops nearly everywhere, and there's a huge fuss of them.
Yes.
But there's no fuss when we're presented with the medals, end of story. That's it, you know. There's no more celebrations. But I can just see down the country, they celebrate, they go to schools, and they go, you know, asked here, there, and everywhere, you know. So, and they meet the children and talk to them. But that never happens to the Dublin team.
I think that was just a matter of time, though. At the time, ladies' sports just weren't patronised by most people, even ladies. And therefore, that sort of carry-on wasn't catered for, not even in the men's sports at that time. It was only at a later stage that they started visiting hospitals and so on, and that the counties made more of their county team when they won.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't win until 84, and it was about that time they started doing that sort of thing.
Yeah. Do you feel...
As a norm.
Yeah. Do you feel, Patricia, as if what's happening now in terms of being honoured in Croke Park this summer, for example, is that filling in those gaps a little bit? Do you feel you're getting the appreciation?
Well, I've never expected great expectations from anybody. I just loved playing, and it was just a joy to represent your county. And the fact that you won would be a bonus every time, of course. But the idea of going back 60 years and finding all the people concerned in that year and ringing them for a special lunch so that we could all meet up again, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
It still is. We're still 1 year to go. And I thought that was a terrific idea and a very generous one.
I think it's fair to say that there is nowhere near the information around your team that you deserve. And I mean, not only in terms of the games that you play, the finals that you won, and some sort of depiction of the great players, which is a shame, But we do have the opportunity today to, well, I have the opportunity to learn first and foremost, our audience does as well, a little bit about your own backgrounds and the greatness of your team. Okay, we might start with yourself, your own venturing into camogie as a young girl. When did you first play and what was your introduction to the sport?
When I was growing up, it was during the war years, so there was no cars on the roads, and bus service was very limited where you could go. So I just played hurling on the street in Dublin. I hadn't heard of the word camogie even.
Right.
And it wasn't until I went to secondary school, I was boarding in Clagmacross in County Monaghan, that I actually heard of the word camogie. And we got training there from a brother, number one, from the brothers in Carrickmacross, our brother Patrick, and we played two matches a year. We played against Monaghan and we played against Dublin, and that was the extent of matches that I played between 13 and 18. And then I came back to Dublin, I got a job, and I didn't play camogie. I didn't even realise that it was camogie played in matches in Dublin and all that, because we didn't have any access to papers, or there was nothing in the papers about it, you know. So and again, it was again, petrol only came back to Dublin around 1951, and I left school in 1952.
Right.
So anywhere you went, everybody cycled. It was just by chance that I got going back to camogie. A friend of my father set up the primary schools,
the Cumann na Munscoil, is
Cumann na Munscoil, you know. And but he never, my mother was anti camogie, she never went
really?
Absolutely. So my father never encouraged me to play it, because she never saw me playing, she never came to a match.
Oh. Wow.
And so it wasn't ladylike. So it was just a teacher in my father's school kind of said, he knew somebody that were looking for players, camogie players. And so I arranged to go up to the Plainfield and Phoenix, the Phoenix Park, and I met Patricia's father, John Timmins, and he was absolutely marvellous in that he went up there every Sunday, hail, rain or snow, and he was there. Even if nobody turned up, he was always there. And he was a really fantastic player, so he asked me to join. So I hadn't a clue about playing matches.
Yes.
As I said, we got two matches a year, one about against Monaghan and one against Dublin. And so I hadn't much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, clue about it.
There's so much in that. The playing on the streets, playing hurling on the streets. Are you one of a number of girls playing hurling on the streets, or are you just joining in with the lads?
Well, only about one or two girls.
Okay.
You know, so it was a hurley to me, like it wasn't camogie.
Yes.
Know? And all that, we played a lot, you know, we did an awful lot of running.
Yeah.
That we'd have competitions between ourselves, running around the block, there was a block of 12 houses, you know. That's why I got, I was very fast running, and I think that was an advantage. And I keep saying to anybody today, would you ever increase your speed, particularly to the Dublin team? And I said, if you don't get to the ball first, I said, you're not going to do any good, so you have to be fast on your feet.
You know? Yeah.
And I still think, even though the game is totally different than what we played. We played nearly all ground camogie.
Yes.
Where now it's all kind of in the air and that they're playing. Now it's very stylish, and I'll have to say I think they play fantastic camogie nowadays. They're really fantastic and very fast. You know, but still, you have to have the speed to get to the ball.
Yeah.
If you don't get to the ball, they're not going to do any good.
So the club, Patricia, was Naivifa.
Naivifa, that's
Talk
correct.
To us about Naivifa.
Well, a priest in my parents' parish started it for the women of the parish because they had no outdoor outlets. The boys were well catered for with Gaelic games and soccer and athletics, but the ladies had nothing, the girls had nothing. So he suggested if anybody would like to play camogie, we would try and start a team. That's what happened. My mother became a founder member. But then he realised that they really had no idea how to hold a stick, never mind play with it. So he encouraged my father to come and teach them how to play. And he took it on. He was an athlete. He did train some senior hurlers, in fact, as well, I believe. He didn't ever tell me that. I heard it from an aunt. But he took us on and he trained them from the very beginning when they weren't able to hold the sticks until eventually we got to the point where we got into the senior ranks and won, I think it was 66K, we won the league and championship for the first time as a club, which was a tremendous pleasure for Dad to be able to think that we came from the very lowest of the low juniors and continually improved till we got this far.
Yeah.
he loved it, and so did my mother. She was up refereeing and umpiring, and she went to the board every day, every week. We had weekly board meetings, and my Sundays were up early for mass, back home, get a breakfast, straight up the park, and we either had training at 11 or matches at 11, and hopefully I'd get on the senior team. We had like a junior team as well, but if anybody was late arriving for our club matches, as a senior club matches, I would be able to go in and play a little bit till somebody came, and this was my goal, because you must field a team with at least 9 out of the 12, and if you don't have 9, the other team got the walkover.
Yeah.
So if any of our team were late, so that we had only 9 to play with, and I made up the 9, this was my hope when I was growing up, that I'd get a few minutes on the senior pitch to play. Eventually, of course, I managed to get at the senior team and my own team.
So Patricia, what was what were the rules of the game, I guess? Because it seems, from what I've read, again, footage is impossible to find from this era. There's like one YouTube video of, I think there's an Ireland versus England game somewhere in England. I think that's the only YouTube footage of camogie of that era that exists online. So you'll have to educate us on what the game actually looked like. So as you allude to there, it's 12 players a side.
12 players a side. You have a goalie, a fullback, 3 halfbacks, a centre field, 2 wings, and then you have the same at the top. You've got the full forward and the half forward and that was your centre forward, and that was your 12.
Okay, were the posts the same as they look today?
Nope, the posts had a top rung, and you had to, for a point, you had to be between the bottom rung and the top rung, and that was a point scored. But you couldn't go over the top rung, that was nothing, that wasn't counted.
Right, so it had to go over the bar, but under the other bar.
But under the other bar,
right,
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
What was the thought process there, or why did that rule exist?
I don't know, actually. I think it was more to gauge, to give us a little bit more skill effort to get it between the two, not sky it.
And was that like a postage box sort of thing, or was it easy enough?
It was quite a good distance. It was more than the distance between ground level and the first bar.
I see.
It was about, not quite double, but 1.5 anyway.
Okay, that's a pretty good picture of it.
Yes.
So goals dominated the game.
Yes. Well, if you're lucky enough, points, but goals because of our ground play, I suppose. When you had freeze, of course, that's when you pointed.
Yeah.
Because you're rising the ball to point. Mostly, as Kay says, it was ground play. But you could catch the ball on the hop and you'd have a high ball any time.
Okay.
And that seems to be, I think, the past. It's not used that much, as I can see it now anyway. And of course, we cut the balls from the sideline, as they still do.
Yes, we do know a little bit from a brilliant exhibition that was done around camogie artefacts a couple of years ago, and on display was the garb that ye wore. Talk to us about that.
Well, mostly. We had gym slips.
Okay.
Mostly. And you'd have a blouse underneath it and a sash and black, long black stockings, at least the early years was all like black stockings. And we only had what were called hockey boots, which were canvas boots, because the leather boots hadn't come in at the time we were playing our first intercounties anyway. So your feet got very wet if it was anyway wet on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, if the grass was wet and that. And of course, if you got a wallop of the ball, and you felt it more than you did if you had leather boots.
I can imagine.
Yes. But gradually the leather boots came in and that helped. And in the Dublin uniform, that was a blue. It was called St. Patrick's Blue, which was a mix between a pale green and a blue. And it was made of light wool material. You had your number sewn on the back, and if you had to change gyms so that it didn't fit, you may have to be given your number to sew on for the day so that your number 9 instead of number 3, that uniform fitted better.
And who would sew it on?
Oh, the player.
Right.
Yes. And the player provided their own blouse, white blouse, and their own sticks and boots and everything. There was no such thing as sponsorship.
Yeah.
And you went there on the bus, or you cycled, or you got a lift with somebody. But I remember going in the bus. Dad didn't have a car at the time. He never drove. We went most places on our bikes. But when we went to Croke Park, we took the bus because we used to have a meal afterwards with the opposite team.
Okay.
And then the medals were given out at that meal, and we'd have a sing-song and so on. It was very innocent stuff and very enjoyable.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are your memories of the uniform and the woolen frock in particular? Okay, because I must say it does look and less than ideal for athletic performance.
Yeah, more than less than. it was on a hot day, you know. You didn't collapse with the heat, you know. And you were just muffled up, but that's all you could say. And you can't play any sport kind of muffled up, you know. But it was very, very warm because it's a long woolen, long socks, the kind of the heavy gym slips, you know. And we had that all the time, you know. So it was very hot, but what, you know, that. And if it was raining, the whole uniform got wet, soggy wet, and be very heavy on you. Oh, so
I don't think any of that really bothered us too much at the time.
No,
because we were so delighted to be on a panel representing Dublin. It doesn't matter if they asked us to go out in sackcloth and ashes, we'd be happy to do that.
It's fascinating where Camogie actually sat at that point. Like, it's really interesting, Kay, that you'd never heard Camogie, the word used before. If you go back through the Roll of Honour of Camogie, Dublin won the first All-Ireland as far back as 1938. So the sport existed, but obviously in a very, very small capacity. And look, I'm sure your mother was far from the only person in Dublin at the time who thought it was, you know, not right for women to be or girls to be out playing.
Point, a lady could play tennis. End of story.
Was that it?
Oh, no, he had no running now either.
Right.
Anything like that, you know. And, like if there was no write up about a match on a Tuesday to be a paragraph in the Evening Herald. But that's all the reports on the matches. You know, there's very little reporting on Camogie matches.
Yeah.
And,
Did you realise that you were trailblazers at that point? That you were going against the curve in terms of what Irish society was telling young girls to do?
No, kind of. Again, like only reading back now about 2003, I think it was 100 years since the Camogie was set up. And it said that, again, they had to travel to matches on buses, and they used to have to hide their sticks, the Camogie, inside their coats.
Right.
And they wouldn't dare get on the bus holding a hurley. They'd get terrible abuse from men on the bus about women kind of playing hurling. And
was that something you had to deal with as an intercounty player?
No, you were not okay. At that stage. I was just reading about when they started her off a new CD, I think, and that they had to hide their sticks if they were travelling by public transport.
Okay.
And people were so much against women playing a sport like that. And
Can I ask you, Kay, it's a broad question, but what made your Dublin team so great? As I say, the 10 in a row is an astonishing thing that's never been done in any of the senior codes at intercounty level. How come you're the ones that did it?
I think that it was nearly all the same players. It was only ever kind of one or two new players brought in on the team. So there was great cohesion against the player. And I could tell nearly where, I played centre forward on the Dublin team, and I could tell where the forwards were exactly without turning around. I would know kind of where to hit the ball. And this was this understanding between them because we were playing so long together. And that kind of made the team kind of why it was so good at that time. You know, the same players all knew kind of where the ball was coming from and who to hit it to, and knew where they would be, you know, without even looking round.
Yeah.
You know where they'd be, out the corner of your eye, you know where they'd be, you know.
So it was a similar enough team year in, year out?
Yes, yeah. Okay. You'd only have maybe one or two different people.
Yeah, well, Patricia, different. I presume you're one of the new people one of the years, right?
I was one of the years, yes. Yes.
At what stage do you come into the setup?
In 1962, in my mid-teens, yes.
Can I ask, what did you think of a player like Kay Ryder when he came into the team, somebody who'd already got a few All-Irelands under her belt and had proven herself to be a great?
I'm well used to Kay because she played in our club.
In the club, of course, yes.
And, of course, I was well aware of her status.
Yeah.
And it was great to play with her and the other, because I used to feel, starting off in 1962, I was in awe of whom I was playing with because they were so good. And so cohesive, as she says, as a team. There was no calling out for the ball. There was no need. They also, we were trained to hit the ball, keep the ball moving. That was one of the things that our late trainer, Nell McCarthy, used to keep telling us on the side, keep the ball moving, move it, don't mess with it, and move it to somebody, direct it. So this is how the cohesion of the players came to be. We knew where everybody was and where we should hit it to and so on. And if anybody went along with their ball and the stick as they do now, they wouldn't be considered for the paddle.
Really?
Ever. No, showing off? Like, no, never. Never. Totally different game.
Talk to us about Nell McCarthy then, your coach. A Cork woman?
A Cork woman, yes, yes. But she licked us into shape, put it that way. And her idea was, to keep the ball moving, but to keep it to somebody always and not mess. And certainly if you want to rise, you've got to be quick. And in my memory, the other county teams we came across were more used to high play, like getting it into the hand and hitting it from the hand. They were faster at that than we were. And we counteracted that by being better on as ground play.
Yes.
And we had this thing of keep it moving and moving it to somebody instead of just into the white wilderness where nobody was likely to be.
Okay.
It was thought out in that way.
And how did she end up exiled in Dublin?
She came up here to work as a civil servant.
Oh, fair enough. Okay.
Yes, that's how she started here, yes.
What do you remember about Nell, Kay? That she goes down clearly as one of the great
coaches.
Oh,
she was very, very stern. You wouldn't dare question anything she said, you know, and you wouldn't dare kind of, as Patricia say, show off. You just hit the minute you got the ball, you hit it, and you hit it to whoever you had in mind to hit it to. It wasn't just you didn't kind of you didn't try to score yourself from the centre of the field or anything like that. You always had knew who you could pass to and that they'd get it up to the three forwards in the front, and you knew that one of them would get it. Now, mostly the three forwards were the same. It was Una O'Connor, Judy Doyle, and it was always A.N. Others.
Okay.
So yeah. I was inclined to hit to Judy or to Una. And, but Una used to be so well marked, you know, that it was, generally speaking, easier therefore to hit to Judy. Now, Judy was small and fast. And because she was small, you didn't seem to notice her. Now, I was tall, but people didn't notice Judy. And again, she was so fast on her feet. So if you could get her to Judy, she nearly always got a score. And kind of they'd be double marking Una, you know, so that even though Una was great at scoring, but she'd be marked so well that there was a better chance of Judy scoring.
Okay, she was the speedster. She was the one with all the pace. We get into some of the great moments in just a moment. I am very curious, though, as to what happened in 1956. I don't think you were a part of the panel, although you might have been.
No, 56. I was part of the panel, and actually I was down on holidays, and Dublin used to get a bye into the final in the Leinster every year. And in 1956, they decided, no, Dublin would have to play all the other players, all the other teams in Leinster.
Right.
And they kind of just got the team together, but they never even had a practice. And I was down in Galway on holidays, and I rang Neil McCarthy and I said, I'll get up, come up on the train. Ah, she said, no, don't bother.
Right.
She said, it's only kind of a match against, I think it was Kildare, I'm not quite sure. And she said, like, kind of, it's not worthwhile coming up, you know, thinking that they were going to win. There was kind of a no runner, you know, that all. And then because they weren't expecting any opposition, and if you go out with that attitude, and once you're kind of have that attitude, it's very, very hard mentally. If you're not prepared mentally to go out and fight for every ball, you cannot mentally get back into that fighting spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you have to be careful of. Even if you're winning by a huge score, don't relax.
Patricia, were you going to many of those games as a spectator before you were involved in 1962?
Oh, absolutely. My mother
was there at the time.
Either chairman or vice chairman of the Dublin board all my life, as far as I can remember. So, of course, I was going to all the matches, and these were my icons, the people playing. That's when I started myself. I still was in awe of who I was playing with. But I certainly, yes, was at all the matches. And
what made that team so great, Patricia? Two
or three things. One, the discipline. They were ready to be told how to do and what to do, and they did it. And secondly, the idea of keeping the ball on the move and passing it accurately to another member of the team. And three, keeping your places relatively well instead of running after the ball or over the field, and marking your players when you need to mark your players, stick with them.
Okay.
Those three things. And as Kay says, we did train, but we weren't as fast as the players now are on the field. And she's right there. We could have been faster, as the teams are now, or most of them, but they're doing a lot more in athletics now to make sure that they can sprint and can keep it up for the length of the game.
What was your fitness regime?
Well, we ran around the tracks, and we did sprints and so on, and we did exercises, and we did playing against forwards against Black and all that sort of thing, and practicing on the sidelines and the 30s, and it was 30s in those days, and taking freeze, you know, from the back line, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And that does take practice. It's like any game. You practice your free taking to become as accurate as you need to be.
Is there a moment then that does stick out as your finest hour, even as a team, when you were going on that run?
I know when I became captain and receiving the cup in 1965, that I was hoping that we'd win, you know, in 65 and 66, that stood out as the most memorable time, you know, being captain of the Dublin team. And it's just a wonderful feeling, you know. It's very hard to describe. It's kind of very emotional, and you want to kind of, you're afraid you might forget to praise people or kind of do the right thing, you know, and that you're on the air. But that was kind of, I really felt kind of so proud of the team that you feel the whole, really are proud of the team, you know?
Yes.
When you're captain. It's
The thing about your captaincy as well is that it's at the end of that amazing run.
Yeah.
And we're into the mid to late 60s at this point. Ireland is changing a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you start to feel the appreciation as a camogie player then from the naysayers? I know you mentioned before that your mother maybe wasn't overly fond of the idea of you playing. Did she come around by that stage?
No.
No?
No. She never went to a match, you know. And I remember once playing in a match where playing against Mayo. My father was from Mayo, and I was about to take a 30. Was it 30s we used to take?
30s.
And I was just out, and in the silence, where there's always silence, the next thing I hear from the stand, "Oh, Mayo!" And I knew from my father's fight that was my father. But I did score the point anyway.
Yeah.
I was laughing to myself because I knew it was him.
He didn't put you off too much. What about when you came home to the house with these All-Ireland medals? Was your mother not at least a bit curious about, geez, I've got one of the best camogie players in the country here?
No.
No?
No. My father was very, very proud of me, you know, because when he started off the primary schools or coming a month ago, there were six of them in a flat on the Capitol Road.
Yeah.
And they all said, when they got married and they had boys, the boys be all playing in Croke Park. And none of the six men that were there at the time, they had boys. My father had four girls.
Right.
And he was the only one that had anybody playing in Croke Park.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And the others had boys, but none of them.
Where do you keep your medals?
Well, I have them at home in the safe, you know. I got two lovely bracelets made at my 10. Patricia's father made the bracelets, you know. And
so
he made the bracelets for me, you know. And I have two daughters, so I can give five to one and five to the other. One girl is definitely not sport oriented. The other girl would have been very, very good at any game she took up, but she wasn't interested in playing any. Like, she's marvellous at tennis. She played hockey. She played badminton. She was always number one, you know.
Right.
But she wasn't interested in competing, you know.
Yeah.
But, and
The bracelets is something I've read about, Patricia. This is the family business. The jewellers, they still make the current Celtic crosses. Your relatives.
I continued the business from Dad.
Yes.
As much as I could.
So it's your children that make the Celtic crosses.
We don't actually make them. We don't make a lot of jewellery now.
Okay.
But he was into jewellery and medals. Medals was his main thing,
right,
making medals. Mostly for GAA, soccer, any sport, but it was by hand. Stamped it and the enamelling and everything like that. He did with the pestle, mortar and pestle.
Oh, no way.
And he had to grind it into, very slow process. But as he aged, he wasn't able to keep going as much, and I was trying to keep I would hate his name to die out. So I used to give him a hand as much as I could. I'd do whatever book work was necessary, of course, and help him with getting to the assay office because he didn't drive and he used to go on the bicycle. So when I was in a position that I could drive him there, I would do that. So we now have, my husband found this magic machine in Italy, which nearly bankrupted us until we got it working. But it was churning out metals so much faster than the handmade ones.
Yes.
So we've kept the business going through that. Its core was metal making. But we do trophies and we do embroidery. We do all sorts of things now. We do bespoke trophies. We did some lovely bespoke stuff for film people and for annual trophies that they wanted something different.
Okay.
If they had an idea in mind, we'd try and make it up. And we do medals and trophies for all of the sports, every sport we have in Ireland now, thankfully, and some abroad. We've done the UN medals, all that we used to do, the guards' insignia and the soldiers' insignia and all of that sort of stuff. So right. It's certainly kept us going.
You've actually brought the bracelets in with you, Kay.
I just wanted to show you the bracelet.
They're absolutely amazing. So, five on each bracelet here with the Camogie Association crest on it.
The
beautiful
dates
shields.
Are at the back.
And the date on each one, of course. So, this is going from 1955 all the way up to 1966, this bracelet.
So I had the two bracelets.
Fantastic. You have them as well, Patricia, I believe.
Mentioned to bring them, so there you go.
Yeah, a prize possession, to say the least.
Prize possession,
Slightly different bracelet effect.
Right. Amazing. Yeah. There's a stronger chain on this one anyway.
Yes, well, I got that as a present from my husband, and I decided to put the medals on it instead of charms.
So. Yes, okay. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then one on a badge as well.
Yeah, on a clip. This is the first one,
Amazing, and it says as well on the back of one of the... It says, "All my love, Liam," it says on the back of...
that's where I got the bracelet from first,
They're beautiful.
Four
on the bracelet, and then Dad had made that with the first one. He'd already done that. And the rest start coming.
It's absolutely fascinating. There's loads more that I'd love to ask you. There's just a... one or two other things just to kind of tie this all together. After the 10 in a row, Patricia, it's been mentioned in this conversation already, there's only been one more All-Ireland won since then. Like, so it was 25 titles Dublin had won in Camogie by 1966. And between 1966 and 2025, there's only one, 1984. What happened?
Well, in my view, the discipline in a way broke down to a degree. That the team wanted, some of them wanted to do their own thing and have more high ball play or do a little bit of their own stuff on the field. And that, in my view, led to a little bit of resentment between the players without actually voicing it, that why is she not doing as she was told kind of thing? Why break up the pattern that we had of a cohesion? And some people, instead of doing as we had agreed, this person takes threes from the back line, this person takes from the centre, this person, somebody else will come up and say, "I'll take that." And you don't fight on the field. So I think that was partly how Dublin started to, how should I say, lose their cohesion is the best way of putting it. That they didn't stick to the age-old practice of moving the ball, keeping it moving, and keep your places, and make sure whoever's in that position should be good enough to hold that position. And at that time, until I was finished playing, we were not allowed to take players off and replace them unless they were injured and had to come off. And sometimes that too was a problem, because if there's an injured player on the field, she's hurt her leg and she's only limping and she doesn't want to come off, and she's not coming off when she's called off.
Yeah.
That creates an ill feeling between the players in their heads. We never voiced it, but you could see that there was uneasiness. And I think that was partly how we didn't win as often afterwards. And of course, I'm not taking it from the county teams. They increased their ability tremendously and went from being mediocre to better, and they deserved all their wins, all of them. Yes.
Okay. The other thing is, I felt that the other teams went in with a defeatist attitude. They were playing double. They went in with the idea that they were going to be beaten. So I think they beat themselves by going in with this idea.
Right. The mental aspect is so big.
I think the mental aspect in all sport is, like, they haven't, at that time, that wasn't stressed, but my opinion, mental attitude is very essential in all sport.
For yourself, Kay, your life in sport after Camogie involves badminton, golf, you still managed to find the joy in sport post Camogie.
I always wanted to take part, you know, and so unfortunately I had an operation in 1985 and I was forced to give up the golf. Broke my heart, you know, that I couldn't play any sport. I was 85, so I suppose at the time. So I suppose it was about time.
Good innings. Patricia, for some people listening to this might be aware, but you're a mezzo soprano yourself. You have a CD out, so talent in front of a microphone as well as on the field of play, it seems.
Yes. Well, there was a time when I was hoping to make a career of it, but at the time my father was ill, and so I was the eldest of the four of us and the only one earning. So when you have a sole trader and he's not trading because he's ill, he's in hospital, I reckoned I couldn't really take up an offer to go abroad for training, because I reckoned my income was going to be needed. So that's how that went by. I sang as much as I could for weddings, funerals, all that sort of thing, odd concerts. Other than that, well, I managed to get to concerts, tours of the States and Canada, which was wonderful, great experience. But I didn't progress beyond that because of the situation, and then I was trying to keep the business going. So, that's how I.
That's how it went in the end.
The CD is my last swan song.
Swan song is the name of the CD.
Yes.
Very good. I just have one last question. I guess the thing that really sticks out to me about your team, Kay, is 10 in a row. That we've seen other teams come relatively close, like the Cork Women's Footballers, for example, had an amazingly dominant run akin to yourselves, but never did 10 consecutive All-Irelands. I'm wondering, in 1966, when you do complete the 10 in a row, did you realise at that point that that would be a record that would stand the test of time? Because it doesn't look like there's going to be a team that comes along in any of the four or any of the four codes and actually beats that.
Yeah, I think Cork is kind of, they could do it, you know.
Okay, yeah.
That they're very good, and that they've won an awful lot. Kilkenny nearly got there as well. But I think they got over. I think, again, go back, I think it was the mentality of it. They just assumed that Dublin were going to win. And once they broke that, and then, again, for anybody coming along afterwards, they can see that after Dublin won 10 in a row, that it's an old sport. They think kind of even football in Dublin, the kind of Dublin football, had a run.
Yes.
But once that team kind of starts as kind of disintegrate or getting older, you know, and are replaced, then they're beaten. And the same Kerry team as well.
I neglected to mention my own county, Kerry, who won 9 All-Irelands in a row up until 1990,
And then all the players are older, and then you have all the reliables kind of resigning and leaving that. They kind of, you don't want to put them off the team and that, you know, but kind of they are younger players coming up, and then sometimes the younger players in Dublin, they kind of, they think they'll never get on the Dublin team.
Yeah.
Because it's a solid Dublin team there, but the kind of the players are getting older and they're not as good as they were. they definitely started a decline. And
It's an amazing thing, an unbelievable story. It's been a pleasure spending some time in your company and learning a little bit more about the era in which you played Camogie, and the context around it has been so interesting. Thank you so much for coming in and bringing your medals with you as well. They're beautiful pieces of jewellery. You have been listening to Kay Ryder and Patricia Woods, Neil Timmins here in studio talking about their memories as part of the greatest Dublin Camogie team of all time and potentially the greatest Gaelic Games team of all time. We'll take a quick break. Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.